Jan Friedrich, Jesse Knude, my friends here, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's especially a pleasure to be, for once, in the company of a professor whose name is even more famous than my own. Of course, the state of Texas, in which I now live, was not unfamiliar to Marx, Karl Marx. He contemplated emigrating there in 1848 to join the exodus of fellow revolutionaries from Germany at that time. And he wrote very incisively about the politics of my home state at the outbreak of the American Civil War in 1860. The problem at the time, as he saw, was the dominance of a clique of landholding oligarchs. 165 years since, things are very much still the same. I should say, though, that all is not lost for the legacy of Marx in Texas, because some years ago I was teaching a small undergraduate class at the University of Texas at Austin, and I had given them the text of Karl Marx's great letter to Abraham Lincoln in 1865 to read. What begins that the working men of Europe felt instinctively that the star-spangled banner carried the destiny of their class. And a student came up to me afterwards, to a nice young woman from the suburbs of Fort Worth, a town in central Texas. And she said, "You should be interested to know that I am the great-great-great-granddaughter of Friedrich Engels." And I thought to myself, in Texas, anything is possible. My task tonight is to review the economics, theory, and fact of inequality, and to do so in this comparative setting. And since neither the theory nor the facts are settled, they're neither well established, but still very much in the process of development, I would like to begin with a couple of propositions that I will use as foils, to state them in order to examine them in a critical way. The first one is from a professor whose name is heard quite a bit these days, even in this fair city, and it seems to be hard to avoid. I've already heard it once in the introduction, and that is, of course, Professor Piketty. And the other one will come from an older, longer-standing current of what we call the mainstream conventional wisdom. So here's the first proposition that I want to state as a point of departure, or a foil. We'll call it the Piketty proposition. And that is that inequality under capitalism has an inherent long-run tendency to rise, for the reason that the rate of return on capital, what he calls R, tends to exceed the rate of growth of the economy, what he calls G, R greater than G. And that leads to the accumulation of financial wealth in the hands of those who own capital over time. This is a relatively new idea, very much in fashion. It does have the virtue, I will argue, of placing the question of inequality in the domain of macroeconomics, of the general and broad forces that govern our economic lives. But it also has the property of, if you accept it, pushing you to one of two poles of the policy discussion. One pole is fatalism. Capitalism is what it is. We cannot escape from capitalism, and therefore we must accept that inequality will rise. World without end, just get used to it. The other pole is that it pushes some people to is the adoption of more extreme positions. not necessarily the violent revolutionary overthrow of capitalism, which is an idea that has not had recent fashionableness in most parts of the world, but rather, in Piketty's case, the idea that we should somehow value on a continuing basis everybody's financial wealth and tax it away year after year. The grand idea of a global annual wealth tax is the I would regard as the striking policy proposition that emerges from this initial view that inequality is driven by R greater than G. So that's one proposition that I'll come to. Let me state the second one before returning to the first. The second proposition, I think, will be extremely familiar to you as members of the European public. I call it the mainstream conventional view or conventional wisdom, which is that higher inequality, particularly inequality of wages in the United States compared to Europe, reflects the more flexible or more efficient Anglo-Saxon labor market, and therefore is associated with a lower rate of unemployment in general than has been the condition in Europe, where supposedly low rates of inequality, rigid labor markets, are associated with high unemployment. So the choice is the American model, free market capitalism, or jobs plus misery on one side, or the European model, which has socialistic, at least by American eyes, which is to say welfare plus unemployment. A very nasty choice. And it's a choice which for many years was something that was, as a defined proposition, something that both left and right agreed upon. The right said, yes, that's the choice and you should choose the American model. The left said, yes, that's the choice and you should choose the European model. Right? Which made for a debate, at least, over a common agreement about the state of the world. What I'm going to argue for you tonight is that both of these propositions, the Piketty proposition and this mainstream view about labor markets, are false. That they're false as a matter of theory and as a matter of fact. Now, if you read Professor Piketty's book, all 671 pages of it in the English translation, and if you read it carefully, you will discover that there is one exception to the general rule of rising inequality as a result of R being greater than G. What is that exception? It's called the 20th century. It's a rather lengthy exception, beginning around 1914 and carrying on at least to the 1980s. And Professor Piketty tries to find excuses for the 20th century, in particular laying at least some emphasis on the proposition that a great deal of capital was destroyed in the two world wars. In fact, it's not actually true that a great deal of physical capital was destroyed in either world war. In World War I, something that John Maynard Keynes already noted in Economic Consequences of the Peace in 1919, the capital destruction of capital, economic capital, was massive in only one country in that war, and that was this one, in Belgium. In France, it was very limited. In Germany, it was non-existent. There was no destruction in capital. There was no aerial warfare in Britain. So the idea that the physical destruction of World War I was that traumatic simply doesn't hold water. And even in World War II, the physical destruction of economic capital was not all that large. There was really very little in Britain, notwithstanding the Blitz, knocked down a lot of housing, didn't destroy a lot of industrial capacity. In Germany, and it was virtually none in France because France capitulated. In Germany, the bombing did not prevent industrial production, military production from rising right up to early 1945 or late 1944, something that was uncovered by the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, of which my father was a director. Other very distinguished economists took part. Japan was a little bit different, but even in Japan, the destruction, the massive destruction, was of wooden cities, which were not themselves deeply, they were not massively capital intensive to begin with. So that wasn't what happened in the 20th century. What happened in the 20th century was the construction all across the world, in the United States in the 1930s, and in Europe in the post-war period, as well as in Japan, all across the developed world, of established systems that stabilized the distribution of income, that provided for the effective taxation of high incomes, the progressive income tax, for the effective taxation of corporate profits, the corporate profits tax, and for the creation of stable sources of social insurance which stabilized the incomes of working people. That is to say, Social Security, public retirement, health care insurance, unemployment insurance, deposit insurance so people didn't lose their money in the banking system, a whole sequence of 20th century institutions. Plus a certain amount of recycling of capitalist accumulation into consumption expenditures, which is particularly important where you have, where that is advantaged by tax measures, which is the case in the United States. And when you put all of those things together, what you find, and I do this sort of analysis, at least analytically, in a paper that's just been published in the World Economic Review, is that there's no necessary reason why the simple fact of the rate of return being higher than the growth rate will generate an increase in inequality. It could have, could be stable, inequality can be declining. The 20th century was not an anomaly, but rather a construction which has not, even today, entirely been unmade. Which means, if that's correct, that under the systems in which we live, inequality is not necessarily fated to rise, and we can be at liberty to think about the policies that will prevent it from doing so. That's my simple point on Piketty's proposition. To see this, to ask what happened instead, it is useful to put together a set of measures of inequality which are different from those that Professor Piketty used. What he relies on is long time series, long historical records for a small number of countries. What I have been engaged in for many years is a superficially similar but in many ways quite different exercise, which is putting together shorter, but still 40, 50-year time series for a very large number of countries. Let me see if I can show you here at least part of them. This is a data set, which I will not describe in detail, of a particular concept of household income inequality, which we calculate from looking at distributions that we can actually measure. It gives us a great many countries over a great many years, almost 4,000 observations over almost 150 countries for the period now from 1963 to 2008. And just to show you a few of those countries and the unreadably small Gini coefficients that appear on that chart, but you can see how the low and the high and the changes are evolve over time through the color schemes. This is what the data set looks like if you expanded it to 149 columns. It covers most of the world and gives you a pretty good comparative estimate of the movement of inequality over time. And one thing I can do is show you just decade by decade averages of what's happening to inequality in the world economy as a whole in this period. If you look at the coverage, it's not so great in the 1960s, you can see that there is a significant, the blues, of course, are low inequality, the hotter colors are higher inequality, there's a significant differential between the rich countries and the poor. And as you move over into the 1970s, and into the 1980s, and into the 1990s, and into the 2000s, the inequality rises across the globe, more significantly in some places than in others, with, at the end of this period, only a handful of North European and Central European countries still in that blue range of relatively low inequality. So that's the broad picture. Inequality does rise in this period. There's no dispute over that. But the question then is it rising always and inevitably, or is it rising at particular times more rapidly than others in particular places? One way to look at that question, and I hope I don't run through this too quickly that it's impossible to absorb, is to elaborate the information set, first of all, by looking at other ways of calculating the movement of inequality across particular countries and regions, like China or the US or Europe, or in fact, you can do industrial wage inequality around the world, and looking at either levels or changes over this time. The chart for income data in the US did not come through in this translation of this slideshow to this computer, but here's a little map which shows you the contribution of individual counties to overall income inequality in the US measured between counties in the late 2000s. And you can see, let me see, is there a something here which I think, yes. You can see that the area around New York City is a very rich region. We also have them, obviously, in Northern California and up in Washington State. There are also areas of the real estate boom and bubble that show up very clearly on a map of this kind. And you can do a map like this for any year that you choose. The overall pattern of inequality in the United States in this period is to go up in 2000, go up in 2007, and go up again around 2010. It very closely maps the movement of asset prices, the stock market, real estate prices, and so forth in the US economy. And the sequence of credit bubbles is what's driving the overall movement of inequality. If you look at China, you can see the rise in inequality. It begins in the early 1990s and rises actually to a peak around 2008, and then there is some evidence of decline after that period. It runs up to 2012 in this data. That decline can be disaggregated into two pieces: inequality across regions, which peaks in the early 2000s, and inequality across sectors, which peaks with the crisis in 2008. So this is a very interesting finding, which is exactly new in the literature. It has not been seen, I think, by any, well, it has been seen since we did it by one other researcher, but I think it will become more and more acknowledged to be the case as more evidence comes in. If you look at the inequality across Europe, I can make you a calculation for you, which has actually not been made previously in the literature because it goes all across the European regions, treating the continent as a single coherent entity. And you can see that in the financial crisis, inequality in Europe actually declines, both, let's see, between regions and between sectors. So we see a sort of parallel movement. It's easy enough to see what the source of that decline is. This is the contribution of the financial sector to inequality in Europe. And it obviously peaks in the boom and reduces in the slump, which is not a big surprise, but it gets back to the point that Jan Friedrich was making in his introduction, that these movements are heavily driven by the relative contribution of or share of the financial sector in the total flow of expenditures. These are particular numerical calculations, which I won't try to explain, but they can represent the contribution above or below average income sectors to the overall inequality of the system. And it's clearly being driven by the movement of finance. And if you look at where that's happening, you can see that it's very substantially being happening in the financial center of London. Which makes a very significant contribution to the overall movement of inequality in Europe as a whole. London and Paris representing very big registered income levels compared to practically any other region that you can name individually. So very substantial effects that can be shown as regionally and sectorally specific. Okay, so what is going on here? I would argue that we have events which are occurring over a specific time frame and that are not by any means universal. What's the time frame? In the world economy as a whole, the rise in inequality is most marked in the years from the late 1970s, particularly the early 1980s, up through 2000. After that, the evidence becomes much less clear. And indeed, as I've just shown you, in Europe, in China, and also in South America, and I'll get to some evidence on that in a minute, you see market signs of decline. Well, what happened in the early 1980s? What happened was Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. What happened was the triumph of the neoliberal ideology. What happened was the triumph of monetarism, of rising interest rates, of global financialization, which put enormous pressure on the countries of the developing world, initially in Latin America, initially in Africa, later on in Central Europe, later on helping to contribute to the collapse of the Soviet Union, still later in Asia, culminating in the Asian financial crisis of 1997. One thing after another, which was a response to the pressure of global financial change, and that pressure was itself liberated in part by the application of the neoliberal economic ideology. This is not, by any stretch, something which is inevitable. And indeed, there is good evidence that in parts of the world which have moved beyond that ideology, and this is based on industrial wage data to give you an idea, you can see this is changes in inequality, not levels now, so this is over 6-year periods. The blues represent actual declines. The hotter colors represent increases. And you can see that as you move into the 1980s, you get a dramatic shift from mixed pattern with some countries having declining and some rising inequality to one where most countries of the world are showing dramatic increases, particularly in Latin America, parts of Africa for which we have information, and in Asia. And if you go then into the 1990s, well, no surprise, the biggest increases are in the former Soviet sphere and in China, so continuing in parts of Latin America. And if you move into the 2000s, guess what? You hit a peak and things start coming down again. What is happening in the 2000s? Well, we have Russia, we have Latin America, we have other parts of the world which have rejected the neoliberal model and began to develop. They've also had a change in their external conditions, which is favorable, higher commodity prices, and that may be a major enabling factor. But they are pursuing policies under conditions that have permitted these inequality measures to begin to decline. I'm not saying that they're low. I'm not saying that the declines are yet very dramatic, reaching anything back to previous levels. But the idea that increases are inevitable does not seem to be supported by the data. Okay. That suggests to me, just to come back to our friend Dr. Marx, that inevitable laws of history should be pronounced with care, because there's always the possibility that evidence already available will begin to contradict them. Let me turn to the second proposition. The second proposition was that an unequal wage structure, flexibility in labor markets, was good for jobs, was good for employment. The theoretical cornerstone of that proposition is the theory of supply and demand. Allow wages to adjust so that skill levels are appropriately compensated and employers will give everybody a chance to work. The empirical bedrock of that proposition, that is to say the claim on which it rests, is this comparison between the United States and Europe that I described earlier. Yet, on the theoretical side, there are at least two pretty good counter propositions. Propositions which, at least in one case, are even pretty well acknowledged in mainstream economic theory. In the other case, very well acknowledged by historical experience. The first counter proposition is a model of search for jobs. And that model, associated with some economists named Harris and Todaro back in the 1970s, argues that if you have a lot of inequality, people quit the bad jobs to look for better ones. They quit the farms and go to the cities to line up at the factory gates looking for work. Right? You can see this very clearly, for example, in post-Francoist Spain. unemployment goes up when people start having the liberty to move. You can see it very clearly in modern China. People leave the countryside and they take the train and they go to the towns looking for jobs because the pay is better. And the inequality sponsors migration. You can see this, of course, in the movement from East Europe to West Europe or from Poland to the UK. It's a universal phenomenon. And there should be no surprise that it's associated with a lot of unemployment, because in an unequal society, there are fewer good jobs than there are bad ones. That's what being unequal actually means, right? So that's one proposition which suggests that higher inequality should not lead to better employment outcomes, but to worse employment outcomes. And the second one is the Scandinavian model, the so-called Rehn-Meidner model, the model of the Swedish trade unions in the 1950s, which held that if you kept your pay structure relatively equal, you would attract a better business, a higher productivity enterprise, and you would move up the scale of living standards more rapidly and be able to support a lot of low productivity workers, civil servants and service workers of various kinds, which is how Sweden got rich. Didn't get rich by discovering oil, that was Norway. It got rich by attracting heavy advanced industry, and by doing that, by having a very well-paid workforce, and the less productive enterprises had to either shape up and compete in an open economy or go elsewhere. So there's a second reason why, particularly in small economies, maintaining, this is relevant for Belgium obviously, maintaining a high and equal wage structure is good for international competitiveness. And cutting wages is precisely the wrong thing to do because it will damage your productivity growth in the long run. Now, years ago, an economist who is now at the OECD and doing very well, Enrique Garcilaso, a student of mine at the time, and I showed in a paper that we published that there's, in fact, these relationships can be tested systematically, especially for Europe, and indeed, countries with less equal wage structures had higher, not lower, unemployment. No surprise. Spain, Italy, Portugal have more unemployment than Norway, Finland, Denmark, or Holland. And so the more equal countries across Europe tended to do better on employment than the less equal countries, quite contrary to the labor market flexibilization thesis when you take it at least literally. Okay. So that, I think, is an interesting finding, but it still doesn't quite get to this grand question which is always waved about, which is the comparison between the United States and Europe. On in here, I just want to make 3 points, and then I think I will have close to exhausted my time, so I will wrap up. 3 points, and they may be a little bit controversial. The first one has to do with the notion that the United States is a high inequality country. I suspect everybody here believes that to be the case. The point I want to make to you is that if you have that idea, you probably acquired it sometime in the last 35 years. You didn't have it before that. I grew up in a country that prided itself upon being a middle-class egalitarian product of the New Deal. Right? And of having brought precisely that virtue, for example, into the Second World War. And that perception continued to hold through the full employment years of the late 1960s. At that time, some of what we now call Europe, the Iberian Peninsula, and Greece, until 1974, was still fascist, or under military dictatorships. So not an egalitarian structure. Right? And much of it, much more of it, had been under that control relatively recently, which had not been true. So one has to ask whether the notion that the U.S. is a high inequality country is something which is really reflected by history or something which is a marketing operation of the Reagan period and its successors. Well, inequality did rise in the United States, and it rose, as it did everywhere, in the pay structure. But what I want to show you next, which is the comparison of our numbers, which are basically based upon pay, to the other literature on inequality, is that the rise in inequality in the United States, as measured in incomes, is fundamentally a factor of the capital markets, not of the labor markets. I have a very, very talented student who happens to be Alsatian, French and German, an English trilingual student who has gone through the literature and done comparisons, let's see, of our measures with practically everything else out there, coding the other measures according to whether they are based on market income, gross income, which is close to us, net income, which is disposable income after taxes, consumption, which is not going to be relevant here. And what you can see is that our measures, this is for Canada, are pretty close to the measures, the blue measures in the literature for gross income inequality, which is very nice, that's what we like. Market income inequality is much, much higher. That is because there are a lot of households that don't have market income in any advanced state. Disposable income inequality is considerably lower. One can go through the data for other countries. You can see these measures are extremely messy. There's lots and lots of difference and variation in the literature. But the point is that, at least for the advanced countries, our estimates do pretty well. And when you get to the United States here, a lot of data, but you can see that our measures are actually below the other measures for gross household income inequality, just in the US case, and they're very much different from, they don't reflect these peaks, which you can see here and here. This is the CBO's gross income inequality measure, and that's the disposable income inequality measure. Well, what are those peaks? That's the peak of the stock market in 2000, and that's the peak of the real estate bubble in 2007, I think. That's about right. So what we're seeing here is a vast increase in inequality in incomes in the United States, reported in tax or survey data, but which is largely driven, clearly driven, not by phenomena in the labor market, but by phenomena that's emerging from the capital market. What is that? That's the banking sector, very big in the United States. That's information technology, very big on the west coast of the United States. That's a small number of people with stratospheric incomes, which are reporting those incomes to the tax authorities. Okay. One aspect of this that I would ask you to be careful about in thinking about the United States is the following. We do have an effective federal tax authority. It's called the Internal Revenue Service. If any of you have lived in the United States, you probably have had dealings with it. Right? It's still pretty good. And the habit in the US is to, particularly if you're rich, is you report your income. It doesn't, to nearly the extent one imagines in Europe, go to tax havens. It doesn't, to nearly the extent that one imagines in other places, get simply pocketed in cash or in other ways, particularly not by rich people. Because there are lots of ways to reduce your taxes legally, and it's much better not to get in trouble or to get audited. So there tends to be fairly effective reporting, and what you see may be much closer to the reality in the US than it may be in other places, particularly if you consider that companies in the US tend to be public, raise their money off the capital markets, and therefore report publicly, whereas a privately held company is not required to do that. The proportion of the two is going to make a big difference. So I would argue that yes, the US inequality has gone up, yes, it's capital market related, but one has to be careful about drawing a casual comparison with other countries that have different corporate structures and different tax systems. Third point, and this is really the kicker here. When the United States is compared to Europe, almost always, because of the way the data are collected, the comparison is a country to a country. So we compare the US to Belgium, compare it to Denmark, compare it to Italy, right? Well, I'm sorry, that's not a fair comparison. There are 6.9 million people in Denmark. There are 340 million people in the United States. If you want 6.9 million people of roughly Germanic stock in a cold northern climate with nasty water next to them, we have Wisconsin for that. Right? Wisconsin is much less unequal than the United States. Europe is you're part of a union. I think that's relatively well known here in Brussels. You have a single integrated continental economy. You don't have a single integrated continental inequality measure until I created one. And when you take account of the between country inequality, well, the European measure is going to go up. U.S. measure isn't going to go up because we've already got that. And it will go up in Europe about 30% relative to the other measures, which is a lot. And when that happens, particularly in labor market incomes, which you can compare pretty much directly, it's not the case that Europe has more equality than the United States. Simply not the case. So if your frame of reference is the whole continent against the whole continent, the U.S. actually, over most of the period before the crisis, had both less unemployment and less inequality. And one could make another story about that transition to European integration, but I could argue for you that the rise in the standard level of unemployment in Europe went hand in hand with increasing European integration and increasing effective inequality in Europe, which is just a function of bringing together things that were at very different levels without dealing with it. All right. Let me pass quickly to some broad conclusions. I want to make an argument to you that I'm not going to develop in depth, but just suggest an analogy which comes out of a great deal of other work that I've done. And that's about what is the measures of inequality, these extremely messy measures, what do they resemble? I would argue that they are pretty closely analogous to the measurement of blood pressure in the human body. That is to say, there's a range. It's a range which is considered normal. And within that range, lower is generally more healthy. Right? Blood pressure can be too low. Then you get East Europe, you get sluggishness, you get a lack of dynamism. Zero inequality, zero blood pressure, that's for the morgue, that's for the cemetery. You're not going to find that in living economies or individuals. And then there is the proposition that when the measure goes up, inequality, like blood pressure, it may be asymptomatic. It may, in fact, feel fine. But it's a sign of trouble. It's a sign that there may be a crisis ahead. It's usually a sign of a crisis that's emerging from an out-of-control financial sector, of a credit boom which is going to lead to a bust, such as we experienced in 2007, 2009, and then onwards into the sovereign debt crisis of Europe, which is part and parcel of a global financial crisis. So it strikes me that that analogy is worth keeping in mind. Are there remedies? Yes. But I would argue that the remedies are specific rather than universal. And the idea you're going to come up with one great policy measure for the whole world is fanciful. In the US, I'm in favor of simple policies that have been proven to work. Raise the minimum wage. Raise it by a lot. We have a low minimum wage. Raise the damn thing. Can be done by regulation and the whole economy responds. It's self-enforcing because people know how much they're paid. They can call the bailiff if they're not being paid what they're supposed to be paid. Shrink the banks. Prosecute the bankers. Part and parcel of what happened in the world credit system in the 2000s was one of the most massive waves of financial criminality in the history of the world. And I use that word in the precise technical sense. Crimes were committed. Crimes of financial misrepresentation and fraud. Crimes of abuse of financial power. Those crimes are prosecutable under national law in the United States and in most other countries. They have been, in fact, prosecuted extensively on the civil front, but the criminal prosecution has not been there. It was there in the 1990s. There's experience doing it. There are prosecutors who know how to do it. It's not that complicated to find out when you've got a massively criminal enterprise to get people to testify to that effect. Put people in jail for that, and you will get less of it in the future. Leave them out. And guess what lesson they draw? They draw the lesson that after a certain amount of time, they can do it again. Right? And they draw the lesson correctly that the politicians are in their pockets. This is not conducive to fixing the problem. expand the Social Security system. Just simply make it easier for people who have to leave the labor market because because private sector is not providing jobs, to retire in comfort. Rich regions, the United States, Europe as a whole, rich countries can afford to do that. It is a massively stabilizing force in economic activity. It's very good for offsetting the derelictions of the other players in the economy. We were saved in the United States by the fact that the Social Security system still works. It's very important to remember this, because cutting it, which is on a lot of agendas, is going to have a strictly destructive effect. Europe is, of course, a more complicated case, because you've got countries and you have treaties and you have all kinds of constraints that we actually don't have, or that we got rid of between the Civil War and the New Deal. In Europe, I would refer you simply to a little book that I have co-authored, I'm a minor co-author, with the Greek economist Yannis Varoufakis and the English economist Stuart Holland, now at the University of Coimbra in Portugal, called The Modest Proposal, which outlines a series of policies that could be implemented to stabilize the European economy as a whole within the framework of the existing charters and treaties, within the framework of the Eurozone. That's why it's a modest proposal. But there are four elements to it. One is to use the European Central Bank to effectively stabilize the public debt burdens, the Maastricht compliant portion of the public debt of the sovereign countries of Europe who wish to participate, thereby effectively restructuring that debt, but in a way which does not violate the charter restrictions on the mandates of the central bank. Secondly, resolve the bankrupt banks, starting with Greece, one by one. Right? Put them in the hands of competent authorities rather than allowing them to be privatized back to local landholding oligarchs, recreating the previous political problems. Thirdly, launch a new round of investments under the auspices of the European Investment Bank, relaxing certain requirements which are not functional, but using the technical and financial capacity of the bank and the European Investment Fund to get economic activity going again. And fourthly, create at least some elements of a system of social solidarity that is across, works across Europe. We suggest as a first measure that school lunches would be a very good idea. It is not a good idea for any child in Europe to have to go to school without breakfast or without lunch. Right? Feed them. You could do that at the European level, and you would combat fascism in Greece by doing it. Very useful. My friend Laszlo Andor, the just former European Commissioner for Employment, has suggested mutualizing and having a common unemployment insurance fund. It's a very good idea. Right? I would go beyond that and have a European pension union, which would help to stabilize the incomes of the elderly. Instead of having them cut in the crisis countries, have them supported, but not in a way that requires you to operate through an incapable, diminished, impaired, or untrustworthy national governments. Do all of those things and stabilize the European economy as a whole, and see if you can't stabilize the economies of the crisis states in the process. The basic principle here is, and we mentioned it in the introduction, the alternative to austerity is not simply, it's not simply stimulus. It's not a temporary measure, and it's not an abrupt measure, and it's not a measure that promises miracles. The right alternative to austerity is solidarity. It is to stabilize and protect the most vulnerable populations and to use their stability and purchasing power as a way of stabilizing and ultimately revitalizing economic activity and social activity for all of us together. Thank you very much indeed for your time.